I think when he wrote the question, is man a myth, he was at least somewhat asking the question that the title of his book, The Abolition of Man, raises. Is man disappearing?
I'm William O'Flaherty. Welcome to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. All About Jack is celebrating its 10th anniversary in 2021. This is the fourth episode in the six-part miniseries on the Fawn's Bookshelf, C.S. Lewis on Why Myth Matters. I hope you've had a chance to listen to the other episodes. The author of that book is Dr. Charlie Starr, and he is back on the show today. Plus, Dr. Sarah Waters is also returning to help me with hosting duties. We'll hear from both of them shortly. As noted, this is the fourth show on the book. Last time we explored in detail the second part of the Fawn's Bookshelf. Today we are mixing things up and providing an overview on the last half of Charlie's book, parts 3 and 4. This means that next time, that means the fifth episode, we'll dive deeper into the third part. Confused? I hope not. If so, then just listen to this mini-series a few times and it'll all become clear. So before having Sarah pitch the first question, welcome back to All About Jack, Charlie.
Thanks, William. Glad to be here.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the part 3 and part 4. So they're called Terran Reality as Myth in Narnia and Beyond the Bookshelf. So again, just a kind of overview of what you cover there, key things to highlight. We're going to obviously be tackling them in the next two episodes.
Yes, very good. So in part 3, we focus on the next two books, Men, Monks, and Gamekeepers, and Is Man a Myth? But again, as with chapter 3, I stop in chapter 7 to do some myth theory. Chapter 7 is ironically titled Defining Myth, and I say it's ironically titled because in the chapter, I don't know that I actually do define myth. I explore the development of Lewis's attempt to define myth, and the origins of myth. And I think that really is the first thing you have to do is, if you're studying myth in Lewis, the first question really isn't, so what is myth for C.S. Lewis? It's, where does myth come from? I think that really is the first question. And I mentioned earlier a text I found on Lewis's earliest study of myth. And that was in this little fragment. His final question was, you know, where do dragons come from? Where does myth come from? And his last sentence of that fragment is, we have to confess that we don't know. So at the time, he didn't know where myth came from. That was in 1928, before 3 years before the conversation with Tolkien, right? So chapter 7 then defines myth by looking at the origins of myth and starts to work toward a definition. Chapter 8 then takes up the chapter or the book, Men, Monks, and Gamekeepers, A Study in Popular Legend. And this really was the impetus for the book, because it was the one chapter that made me curious. It was the one book title that made me curious. All right, so if all four of these books have to do with myth, why monks and gamekeepers? So I understood men, because that's in the fourth book also, Is Man a Myth? But why monks and gamekeepers? Well, the answer for gamekeepers came pretty quickly. It's because in a land where the animals talk, you don't need gamekeepers, right? So they are a mythic creature. And then monks took a little bit longer, but it was trying to find the answer to that that ultimately led to the whole book. Now, the answer, I think, is maybe one of the shortest things in the entire book, but I did come up with an answer, and we'll certainly talk about that when we get to this particular part of the book. So finally, then, I talk about mythic reading in that chapter and why I think that the most mythic way to read the Chronicles of Narnia is to read them in original published order, not chronological order. Okay, then chapter nine is Man a Myth? And Lewis would say no and no. And here's what I mean by that. I think when he wrote the question, is man a myth, he was at least somewhat asking the question that the title of his book, The Abolition of Man, raises. Is man disappearing? in the world of pure materialism and psychology that's reduced to behaviorism, is man disappearing, so that the idea of man, as opposed to just animal, as us just being sophisticated animals, is man disappearing? Is that just a myth? And we really aren't special at all. But the other answer I think Lewis might give is no, we're not a myth, and that's our problem, because God made us to be mythic. And our problem is from the fall, we have lost our mythic power. You think, for example, that moment that Ransom kneels before the Lord and Lady of Perelandra, Torin Tinadril, and he says, I've never met a human being before. You're the first real people I've ever met. And he bows before them because they're gods, little g, but nevertheless gods. So we'll definitely talk about that at that point. And then that's the fourth of the books. And so we have to go into part four from there. Part four is entitled Beyond the Bookshelf, because at that point I realized that, you know, the four books in Tumnus's library could get us a long way through studying myth in Lewis, but it couldn't allow us to cover everything. So we needed three more chapters that would allow us to cover everything. Chapter 10 is probably the most important chapter in the book for scholars, but also for people who really want to understand the power of myth. And here I might go back to George Lucas, who once said that myth is psychological archaeology, that in myth we can say something of the way people thought in the far off past. And this is a significant idea. Today we often argue about what is true and what is false, but what about arguing about argument? What about looking at the very ways in which we think? Is it possible that the very modes of thought that we use are limited or flawed? And this is something Lewis learned from his friend Owen Barfield. Had a huge impact on Lewis. So in chapter 10, we look at a variety of things, but we look at myth as a mode of knowing. What have we lost since the Enlightenment, and maybe even before that? What kind of thinking have we lost, and what might the significance of that thinking be, especially in terms of how we read ancient texts, but also how we perceive things spiritually, how we even connect to God? Can myth teach us something about that? And chapter 10, then, I think, answers many of those types of questions. Chapter 11, then, briefly, is on Lewis's love of Norse mythology, which is not really taken up in Tumnus's bookshelf, but which does appear a little bit in the Narnia books and in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe later on, but interestingly, only in the American edition, where Lewis made some changes and added in some Norse elements. That'll be fun to talk about, maybe. When we come to this part. His love for Norse mythology is really what attracted him to mythology in the first place. So I thought, well, we've got to deal with Lewis's love for Norse mythology and some of his earliest poetry. Some of his earliest narrative poetry is his Norse mythology. We think of the dramatic Loki play that he was writing with his friend who was going to write appropriate music to go with it. And then in chapter 12, really is for scholars or just the real fanatics of Lewis interest, where I take up what appears to be a contradiction in Lewis's thought on myth. And since C.S. Lewis is so utterly and completely perfect, as we all know, I'm being sarcastic, but we don't want our favorite writers to have made mistakes. So nevertheless, it actually has been true that there has been this question among scholars who are interested in especially Lewis's epistemology. It goes as far back as Peter Skakel in the 1980s. It's either late 70s or 80s. I know that he was doing work on it in the 70s. At any rate, in The Pilgrim's Regress, there is a line where Lewis says myth is true not the very real. Myth is truth, not the very real. But then in the 1940s, so over a decade later, he writes in Myth Became Fact, that myth connects us to fact or reality, not truth. All right, so that appears to be a contradiction, and I offer a potential solution to that contradiction. And that takes us to the end of the book.
Well, now, Charlie, one of the great things about doing a mini-series a couple years, actually it's been 3 years at the time that we're releasing this since your book originally came out, is that I'm sure you had some initial reaction to your book, but now that it's been 3 years. So, Charlie, go ahead and let us know what has been the response to your book.
So I will say regarding response that the reviews that were published on the book were all good except for one. And the reviewer in that particular journal was wrong. Well, and the reviewer even admitted that that he was hoping for a different kind of book than the book that I wrote. And the kind of book that he wanted was the kind I was referencing earlier, a very straightforward, abstract, but very clear approach to studying myth. And I think that might not be the best way to study Lewis on myth. So I feel pretty good about it even after reading that review. But as is always the case, when your friends or your family or your parents praise and praise and praise, and then they tell you that one wrong thing, that's the one thing that sticks with you for months and years to come, is just that one negative review. Lou Marcos was especially positive in his review. And, you know, he's the kind of Lewis critic who isn't simply going to flatter, made some wonderful notes. One of the nice things about reading the reviews as well is people will summarize points that you're trying to make in ways that are just slightly different or new and unique, and you actually get new perspective yourself about the books that you've written. But, you know, the book has not, you know, sold in the thousands. I tell folks, my books sell in the dozens. And when somebody comes to me and says, hey, I read your book, I go, oh, so you're the one. Mm-hmm. Would be happy then to see your listeners grab a copy of the Fawns Bookshelf and read through it. But it also speaks a little bit to the whole atmosphere is the wrong word, the whole culture or society or community of book writers. We write our books in isolation, don't we? Nobody else knows that we're doing this. I mean, we tell a few friends, but then, you know, they don't particularly, you know, aren't thinking about the fact that we're spending hours and hours working on this project. And then we put the project out there for others. And there may be people who read the book and say, wow, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. But they never come and contact you and say, oh, hey, this book was absolutely fantastic. The couple of times when something like that has happened in my life, it's very fulfilling, especially when somebody talks about the spiritual impact it's had on them. So I really enjoy when that sort of thing happens. But it doesn't happen often, and you just work in your little world and you try to practice some humility. And the moment, of course, Lewis would say, the moment that you think you're being humble is when you're really in danger of pride. But you put the thing out there, and then when you do get to have a conversation about the thing that you've written with somebody who's actually read it, it's really quite a pleasure. You know, it's a great deal of fun. One of the problems, though, that you potentially run into is, if you have moved on to your next project, you've rather forgotten what you've said in the last one. And so when somebody says, oh, hey, let's talk about the Fawns Bookshelf, you think, oh, I'd better grab that off the shelf, hadn't I? Because that I wrote. So that's a great deal of fun. So Sarah, what did you think?
I think it's really interesting the way that you unpack Lewis's conception of myth through his mythic titles. I think it's a really nice lens through which to read myth as a concept, so that it doesn't become pure theory, but it also doesn't become a study about full books, which is the other trap you could fall into, I think. So I think the balance is really good.
One of the things I know I wanted to try to pull off was a writing style that was still rigorous enough for scholars to want to be interested in writing the book, but a writing style that anybody could read. And I think for most of the chapters, I I nailed that. So I'm very happy about that. And I hope that's going to be the case then for many of my books to come. There might be a few people who say, well, you know, you really shouldn't write that way. But I don't know. I, in part, I'm inspired by Lewis. Now, he's a much better writer than any of us here. But he really did have that ability to even write scholarly material in a way that was interesting for a lot of people anyway.
Well, now, when we weren't recording, you made a note that you actually hadn't seen any of the comments that people have left on, like, say, Amazon.com. That's not the only place people could leave a review. But while you were talking, I did hop on over there, and there's one that starts out with two words, can't recommend, and then the next two, highly enough. But then I did want to, someone with the first name of Amanda left one. She writes in the heading, wonderful, highly recommend. And she says, just finished reading this book. I would highly recommend it to anyone who enjoys theology, philosophy, or literature. Charlie is always clear, easy to understand, and a tad funny, making it a pretty easy read considering the sometimes complex content. Thinking on myth always reminds me of why I love God, nature, reading, and everything good. That joy is always worth pursuing. Ah, I need to read a good story next.
Oh, that's delightful. That's wonderful. Encouraging is a really good word because you operate in isolation. And I know that you, William, and you, Sarah, are collaborating on a book, plus you have other writing projects that you both work on. And oftentimes you're just sitting alone in a room somewhere, and you really are isolated. So anytime, and that's one of the joys, of course, of going to C.S. Lewis conferences or doing these podcasts together, is that we get together and to use a lovely modern phrase, geek out on C.S. Lewis. And it's just terrific that we can encourage each other in that way. And I think I mentioned that for a reason. I've recently read a couple of books, one on C.S. Lewis and one on Tolkien, that were written by authors who were incredibly enthusiastic, but they worked in isolation. And the result is that the books were not great. And it was clear that they loved their content and that they were passionate about their content. But if they'd worked with a community of scholars, and the C.S. Lewis community is a great work community to work in, it's not cutthroat at all. They could have produced better if they had gone to conferences, knocked out a couple of short papers on some key ideas, gotten some feedback from folks, developed friendships, which last a lifetime. And I don't want to see C.S. Lewis studies or Tolkien studies either go the way of anybody who thinks they can write a book writes the book. I really hope that anybody who's listening and is interested in doing work in Lewis will join the community before they try to just knock something out. I really do hope that.
I agree. I think bouncing ideas off one another is the way good scholarship is formed. So a little bit earlier, you alluded to another book project that you're working on at the moment. So could you tell us a little bit about that and how that's developing?
Yes, thank you for asking. And I can happily say that literally 5 days ago from when we made this podcast together, I sent a new Lewis manuscript to the same publisher who published The Fawn's Bookshelf. A manuscript that I see as a kind of loose sequel to the myth study. This particular manuscript, which is a few thousand words shorter than Fawn's, is a study of Lewis's theory of the real. And it is a little bit more straightforward than the mythic approach, but it is about Lewis's concept of reality. It sounds, a little bit silly. I know part of what gave me the idea was an old comedy album. This was a big thing to do in the 70s and 80s, is that comedians would knock out an album. And I remember the only comedy album I ever bought was the first vinyl LP from Robin Williams, and it was called Reality, What a Concept. So I bought Reality, What a Concept, and I memorized it, and I think that probably affected the choice for this one. But originally, this is work that came from my dissertation, as was about half of what was in the myth book. There is this strange, wonderful sentence in Paralandra where Ransom realizes that the triple distinction of truth from fact and both from myth is part and parcel of that terrible sundering we call the fall. That wasn't quite an accurate quote, but close enough. And when I first read that, I wanted to know, what does Lewis mean, first of all, by the difference between truth and fact? And then how is it that myth can be either true or factual? And that then became my doctoral dissertation. So 350 pages on a single sentence out of Paralandra. So I'm thinking potentially about a loose trilogy of books, which I hope that Kent State in their Black Squirrel line would take up. So then the Fawns would be the first one, the second one, the one on reality, Lewis's theory of the real, and then potentially a third book on truth and reason. But the current one, the one that I've just sent in, then is on Lewis's theory of the real. So here we're talking about what is reality, what is the difference between nature and supernature, Lewis's idea that there could be natures piled upon natures, Lewis's idea that nature is hierarchical, but in multiple ways. It's vertical, it's horizontal, there may be a multiverse, there's an interiority to reality. You think about that moment when they go inside the walled garden in the last battle and to find that there's another Narnia inside that tiny garden, but that Narnia is actually bigger than the one that they just came from. So an interiority of hierarchy. Lewis's idea that reality is sacramental, that it's incarnational. All of these things then are things that I pick up in the book on the real, which I hope then gets picked up again by Black Squirrel. So we're having somebody look at that now, and I'll be delighted if the listeners would pray about that for me, and then we'll see what sort of future projects might come along.
Excellent. Well, best wishes on that, Charlie. Maybe by the time we record the last episode, you might have some feedback, and you can follow up on what you've learned and about what's going on with that new project. Now, I want to kind of turn a corner here and focus kind of on an overall picture here with this question. That is, you make references to many books and essays by Lewis in your book. What are the names of some essential works people should make a top priority to read?
Oh, okay. Wow. So Lewis wrote almost 50 books, and then a number of essays and the like have been collected in other books. And he wrote a whole lot of poetry, which has been collected into a volume. So that's a tough question. Having said that, then let me suggest an answer for people who are new to C.S. Lewis. So if you are new to C.S. Lewis, or you have a friend who is new to C.S. Lewis, where do you start them? Okay. Or if you're new to Lewis, where do you start? For folks who aren't new to Lewis, the answer might be different. But let's just talk about people who are new to Lewis or who have friends who are new to Lewis. I don't think there's anything wrong with starting with Narnia. I think Narnia is a great place to start. Now, unless your friend is one of those left brain engineering types who really must start with a theology, start them on Narnia. But of course, if you start them on Narnia, make sure you have them read the Narnia books in the order that we like to call the right one. All right. And that is the order of publication, not the order in which they are currently numbered. And that, of course, is something William can share with you perhaps on, and probably has already shared on the webpage. Right order to, yeah, that should probably just be in every Lewis resource in the world. You know, the very first thing that comes up on every Lewis webpage in the world should be, this is the order to read the Narnia books in. So there you go. All right. So start with Narnia. Then I would say read Mere Christianity, then I would say read the Screwtape Letters. Now, you can do Screwtape first and Mere Christianity second, but I'd say that's your next two books to do after Narnia. Or again, for the left brain crowd, start them on Mere Christianity. After that, let me suggest something rather unusual. Some of Lewis's best work is in his short pieces. So instead of going to Lewis's many other books, let me suggest that people new to Lewis get three books: God in the Dock, Christian Reflections, and The Weight of Glory. These are collections of Lewis's essays or sermons. And if you read all the essays in those three books, you're going to get some really key Lewis ideas. So there's a really good start, I would think. If you take the Narnia books as a single text, now don't do that because there really are seven of them. So that's 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12 is a really good start. So for people first getting into C.S. Lewis, those are your first 12 books to read. Isn't that something? And then you've made about a fourth of the way through all of Lewis's writing. But that's a good starting place.
Well, that was very interesting, Charlie. And speaking of titles of books, let's have you share briefly about other works you've written over the years.
Well, thank you. I've written in a lot of areas, and though it might be smart to try to write in one area and become known for that, I've had a tendency to want to just write what I felt like writing. So I've written a couple of books which were Bible studies, and I would recommend one of those, though they're both out of print. There is one I would recommend for people who maybe have this particular struggle. The book is called Honest to God, Wrestling Your Way to Intimacy with the Creator. And it was put out by NAF Press, and there are used copies floating around on eBay and Amazon and the like. But for your listeners, let me just ask you all this. If you've ever had a problem and you realized your problem was God, who could you go to talk about it? Because that's a very awkward thing to talk about with a minister, isn't it? You know, hey, Charlie, how are you doing today? Well, I'm fine, Brother John. It's just that I hate God right now. But there is this theme and a spiritual truth in that runs throughout Scripture, and that is God's people constantly wrestle with him. God's people constantly take their fear, their depression, and even their anger at him to God. And so I wanted to write a book about that, and I think that can maybe offer some comfort. I think that could maybe offer some comfort. Now, I have written one other C.S. Lewis book, and hopefully there's a third on the way. My first book is called Light, C.S. Lewis's first and final short story, and it is about a mysterious short story that Lewis wrote about a man who is born blind and receives his sight and then wants to see where light is. And I won't spoil it by telling you the ending of the story, but the ending of the story is so strange and so bizarre. And the light manuscript itself is so strange and so mysterious because it appeared 20 years after Lewis's death, and many have called it a forgery, that it was worth writing a book about. So in the light book, I was blessed to be able to actually publish the light manuscript, compare it to a previously published version of the story, determine whether it really was written by C.S. Lewis, and actually get Walter Hooper to write the foreword to the book. So what a delight that was. So that and Fawn's Bookshelf are my two Lewis books. But then let me mention, if I can quickly, just two more books. And this is this might be interesting for people who enjoy Lewis's science fiction books and wish there were more science fiction books being written from a Christian point of view. Of course, as Lewis famously said, we don't need more Christian books. We need more books written by Christians with their Christianity latent in the book. So I do have a science fiction series. Books 1 and 2 are out, and book 3 will hopefully be out this year. And the series is available on Amazon. The first of the books, which was my sort of pet brainchild for more than 30 years, is called The Heart of Light, A Tale of Solomon Star. And of course, I think it's a good book, but what do I know? Let's get some readers to get a look at it. It is a science fiction book. It is about adventure and spiritual journey. The second book in the series is called The Darkening Time, A Tale of Solomon Star. And it is a war story, though set in the future, which takes up various moral issues and also issues surrounding propaganda. I think it's pretty adventurous, as well as having a few serious notes in it. The third book, which will be called The Aurora Gambit, will hopefully be out soon, and it finishes the war story that is begun in book two. So the hero, Solomon Star, is the center of the series, and as the Lord allows, there might be more books in the Solomon Star series in the future.
Earlier, Charlie mentioned William and I are working on a book, and it's in the early stages at the moment. We don't yet have a publisher. But let's go ahead and have you, William, share a little bit about the project and give us a kind of quick overview.
Certainly. Well, the working title has been as follows: A Concise Guide to C.S. Lewis's Books. Now, a month or so ago, though, when I was visiting with Charlie and Devin Brown when we were down in Montreat, they made some suggestions as well. So we've got maybe three titles. I'll just mention that here briefly. One was Every C.S. Lewis Book, A Concise Guide, or alternatively, A Concise Guide to the Books of C.S. Lewis. So those would be something that we pitching to the publisher. And then as Charlie has noted previously, it's often the case where the publisher will go with a different title and such. But anyway, so what this book does, it presents an overview of all the major titles from the catalog of Lewis's works that are unique and easily accessible. So this will be things that either came out during his lifetime or afterwards that are unique collections. So it's going to cover all the genres, academic, apologetic, autobiographical, his poetry and his fiction in a single volume in a uncomplicated format. So, you know, like the other titles, though, associated with Lewis, those he edited, essay collections and overlaps of other volumes of those collections, and even the letters and quotation books, they'll be mentioned in some type of an appendix, but not in the same format. But basically, the format for each of the major titles from Lewis is we obviously give the title, when it was published, a short summary of who the main audience would be, the genre, then a short summary of the book, original publisher, background, the strengths of the book, the weaknesses, and then depending on copyright issues, we'll have some example quotes. And then it'll also conclude then with themes also found in, and then if there's things worth noting, we'll have a section for that. And then if there's any critical works on the book, we will be sharing that. And so essentially it'll be covered in, we've been saying like a 3 to 4 page summary of sorts of all Lewis's books in a nice quick reference guide. But hopefully it'll be accessible to where a wide range of Lewis readers would enjoy it, because it'll have the wide range of the books that Lewis covered.
Yeah, I think one of the most exciting things for me about the project is that we're connecting books that perhaps other people wouldn't necessarily have thought of to link together with Lewis. Lewis's thought is always really interconnected. And so if you really enjoyed one book by Lewis, and this book will give you kind of a prompt of other places where you might encounter the same themes. And that's quite exciting, I think, one of the exciting things about the project.
And with that, we will conclude this fourth episode of a 6-part series on the Fonz Bookshelf. If you haven't heard any of the previous programs, then check the show notes for a direct link to them. Next time, we will dig deeper into the third part of Charlie's book, a section that is called Terran Reality as Myth in Narnia. Before we go, thank you, Charlie, for joining Sarah and I today.
Thank you, William.
And finally, thank you, Sarah, for being co-host.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Additionally, thank you, the listener, for your interest in this episode of All About Jack. All About Jack is a feature of the website EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm the creator of the show, William O'Flaherty. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com, where you can find a variety of content. It includes, of course, previous episodes of All About Jack. But the most popular part of the site is a series of articles about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written. I also have a YouTube channel called Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. There's a link in the show notes to it. Today, you heard the fourth in a series of six programs from a mini-series about the Fawn's bookshelf that provided an overview of the second half of the book. If you listened carefully, you might have noticed the flow of it was not as smooth as the other episodes. That's because most of this episode was originally recorded as part of the debut show, but later I decided to modify how the series would be presented. Today's episode had the most changes of all the recordings thus far, but despite this, I hope you were still able to enjoy it. Next time you'll hear Charlie talk about the third part of his book in greater detail. You'll find links in the show notes to purchase the book, along with links to previous shows and any other places that were mentioned during this episode, and there's a link to help you locate other shows when Charlie was a guest. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.